The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Lowe's knows how to help you save. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select Whirlpool kitchen appliances. Plus, get an additional 10% off when you buy two or three select major appliances. And when you buy four or more, you'll save an additional 20%. Find the right appliances and features that fit your kitchen's unique needs and style. Shop Whirlpool 4th of July deals at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
You can't guarantee that you won't get shot, abducted, your hospital bombed, and unfortunately that happened several times. You get sniped on the way from one place to another. If I go there and contribute into saving even one life, one child, I think that's good enough for me. Go back again. And this is the first time I see a child crying without a sound. His tears were coming down and he didn't say a word. He looked at me, took the toy and just turned his face away. That broke my heart. I imagined my son is there in his position and I felt so bad. After 2 days, the father came back and he said, "Oh, I'm asking about my son." So I was really frustrated with the dad. That where did you go? Where did you leave your son and go? He said, "I'm so sorry, doctor. When I brought him, the barrel bomb hit our house or our building. I brought him to you and I knew that he's going to be safe in the hospital. I went back to my house to dig out my daughters and my wife. And I just managed to get them out and I buried them. And I came back for my son."
Welcome back to Behind the Knife. This is Patrick Georgioff, trauma and acute care surgeon at Duke University, and we've got a really special episode for you today, one I've been looking forward to for quite some time. And the reason I'm so excited is because of our guest, Dr. Amar Darwish, someone I admire very much and thrilled to have on Behind the Knife. Amar, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Thank you very much for the invitation. And to be honest, I'm a huge fan and I follow the work of your work and the team of Behind the Knife. And it brings me great pleasure to be with you.
Amar is a general and major trauma surgeon at Manchester University NHS Foundation Trust, which is the major trauma center in Manchester, UK. And he has extensive surgical humanitarian field experience and major trauma surgical training in conflict zones, having been deployed to over 50 global humanitarian missions over the last 15 years. He is obviously passionate about helping victims of conflict and natural disaster, and he does so by equipping the doctors in the area, training them up, and providing some really amazing education that we're going to talk about today. Now, you may have recognized Dr. Darwish's name from the David Knott Foundation, where he serves as the medical director and lead global faculty. And the David Knott Foundation was established in 2015 by Dr. David Knott. And we had Dr. Knott, who is the author of the book War Doctor, Surgery on the Front Lines, on the podcast. And that was in July 2020. If you're interested in listening, it's episode 303. And I got to say, I highly recommend you take a listen, because if you haven't, Dr. Knott is really an incredible human being who has been through some really unbelievable things, and he shares them on the podcast. And Dr. Darwish met Dr. Knott in Syria, and Mar's been part of the David Knott Foundation really since the beginning. And this is when it was established back in 2015. And he has been deployed with Dr. Knott to places like Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Ukraine, West Bank, and even Gaza most recently. So Dr. Darwish, without further ado, let's get started. So you were born in Syria and you made your way into medicine. What was your early childhood like, and how did you find yourself on the path towards surgery, and who influenced you the most?
Gosh, where can I start, Patrick? So since at a very young age, I knew that I was so interested in medicine and I wanted to be a doctor. The main reason, because I was born into a family of doctors. So my father's a pediatrician and my grandfather was also a general practitioner. And at those days when I was in Syria, my granddad was very passionate about his work. He used to hold my hand during holidays and weekends and take me with him to his practice, GP practice. And he used to show me how to do things. And I used to watch him and admire the way he cared about his patient, the way he was passionate towards them. And the relationship between the patient and him, how it's developed, the respect they had for him, the appreciation that they had for the work that he was doing. He taught me so many things. He even taught me how to give injections at that time. I was still a child. He used to have a big X-ray machine. And in the 70s and the 80s, X-ray machines, they were very big. You need to fit them in a big room. And he used to have one in his surgery. And he taught me how to take X-rays. And you need to hide in a smaller room to avoid the X-rays. And then take those films and develop them in a dark room. And he used to teach me all of that. And I used to be amazed. Look at the X-ray and I say, oh, wow, you can look at the human body from the inside. This is so nice. Little I knew that when you become a surgeon, actually you can deal with
it. With your own eyes.
Exactly. So he was a role model for me. He was my hero. And later in the life, I came to know that patients who were poor and not able to afford their treatment, he used to treat them for free and go and buy the medicine for them and give them the medicine and a little bit of money on top of that to support them a little bit or their families.
Wow.
They come back after 2 or 3 weeks to him and they're so happy, they're feeling better, they're so grateful to him. And that really embedded something inside my heart about volunteer work, about humanitarian work. When he died when I was 12, it was a big shock to me really and really affected me because, like I said, he was my hero. Went to the UK with my family and my dad was specializing in the UK as a pediatrician. But also I realized that my dad himself had similar values and he was also my role model. He used to do a lot of work to help in the hospital, the NHS, but also in the community and used to volunteer with charities, especially children's charities, to support them, give them the medical advice that they need in the UK and even back home. And my mother was so supportive to him and always tells us the stories of his work and encourages to be passionate about what he does. So I decided to do medicine. And I remember when I was 18 years old, preparing for my exams, college exams to go to university. And at that time, I mean, till now, you open the news and you look at the natural disasters, you look at the wars here and there, conflict everywhere, and you just feel frustrated. I was so frustrated that I really wanted to help. I really wanted to do something. And I was telling my mother that. And with a nice, calming voice, she told me, look, Hamra, finish your studies, finish medicine, specialize, and you can go and help. This is where you'll be able to help the most. Do your specialty and then go and help. That's the time where you'll be the most, you know, beneficial to these people. And I took her advice and really helped me through my medical school. And that what made me decide when I graduated to go and do 2 years to work in North Africa. And that really opened my eye to how much people are suffering in these countries, the limited resources, and how they struggle to get treatment and medicine. And embedded in me, again, that humanitarian work, volunteer work is absolutely crucial in our field. We can share our expertise, we can share our knowledge, and we can, you know, deliver these skills and deliver these practices to doctors and to help our patients in these areas. I continued my work and I came back to the UK to do my surgical specialties. I was so fixed at that. I remember during my housemanship, I had excellent surgeons and excellent doctors who used to train me. As a house officer, I was trained.
Yeah, and how did you decide on surgery as a specialty? Surgery is not the first choice in specialty in terms of maybe public health or humanitarian impact that people might think of. Now, certainly it has a massive impact, but you could have been an internal medicine doctor, an infectious disease specialist, a pediatrician, et cetera, with a more direct path to impact large populations and underserved. And when you were choosing surgeries, how did you link those two to what you knew was going to be a career that was focused, at least in part, and not wholly on this really amazing humanitarian work?
Really good question, Patrick. During my work in North Africa, I was doing my housemanship and spent 2 years there doing that. And I did different specialties, but I felt surgery was the one that attracted me the most. You're faced with very sick patients, very ill patients, sometimes life-threatening emergencies, and you need to make a decision and act there and then. You operate, you deal with the problem, you come out, and hopefully your patient will get better. And I love that about surgery. Don't get me wrong, other specialties are amazing, and other doctors in different specialties, medicine, pediatrics, obstetrics, again, they do their work with passion and they help their patients so much. But I felt surgical specialty was the one that I wanted and that attracted me the most. I had excellent teachers and excellent surgeons teaching me, taking me through doing emergency laparotomies. Even I remember as a house officer, I was doing cesarean sections, emergency cesarean sections with the consultant there because I was on call with the consultant and I was on call with the main man there. And in the night, they go home and it's only me guarding the hospital or the department.
So you went off with your training in the UK and then at a certain point, you found yourself in Syria. And I guess this is a good point to just as a reminder, because we're going to use this as a takeoff point, is the Syrian war. So the Syrian war began in 2011. Yeah, sparked by the anti-government protests during the Arab Spring. And this quickly, obviously, escalated into a full-scale civil war. And this resulted in a devastating humanitarian crisis, hundreds of thousands of people dead, millions displaced, and truly widespread destruction. And there have been efforts at peace. But despite that, the conflict remains unresolved to this day with ongoing violence and political instability. How did you get into Syria? And you met Dr. Nahn in Syria.
I was still interested in doing humanitarian work, and I've already done a little bit of work before 2011. I even went to Gaza on one of the medical missions there. So when the Arab Spring started, and we're watching the news and learning about what's happening in Syria because of my background, because I still had family at that time there, and the demonstration started. It was initially peaceful demonstrations, people going out in the street, demonstrating peacefully for basic human rights, freedom, to have education, health system, fairness in their treatment, and to be able to provide for their families. Unfortunately, after 6 months of peaceful demonstration, they were faced with brutal response from the government forces and from the secret police in Syria. And we started to see the images and the videos of the gunshot wounds, the injuries, and people trying to help who are non-medical and causing more harm. And that really felt wrong to me. I appreciate that they're trying to help, but they didn't know the right thing to do. And I felt that I could help. This is something I really can contribute to and help. So as a British Syrian doctors and surgeons in the UK, we decided to start on doing charity, and we organized our first mission, medical mission to Syria in 2012. And we, through donations from the public, bought several ambulances, filled it with equipment, medical equipment, ventilators, defibrillators, surgical equipment. I remember people driving these ambulances to the Turkish-Syrian borders. And then we went in with the medical convoy into Syria to the non-governmental areas. And there I was struck by the true brutality of this war. The whole health system was collapsed in the northern areas because the government withdrew all the support to it. So the charities had to step in and take its place. So were there field hospitals established in Aleppo, where we went, and these hospitals, they're very limited with resources, very limited with the doctors and the medics there. They've never seen war injuries before. They're just normal doctors, surgeons who did their normal elective work day to day that we see here in the UK or in the States. And it was shock to them to see all these. So we started to support them and help them. We did a bit of training for the first responders and they're non-paramedics, by the way. They're like engineers, teachers who volunteered to go and be first responders. So we taught them first aid. We taught them a little bit about trauma, advanced trauma life support, and so forth. And we came back to the UK, and I felt something, you know, has changed in me. I felt that this is what I want to do. This is where I'm suited the best.
This is the through line to your family, your history, your father, your grandfather, your mother.
Absolutely. And I wanted to take that path and continue on that path. And I always used to think and ask, do you know anyone who does this kind of work here in the UK? And the name David Knott was mentioned to me, but I never knew who David Knott was at that time, till the Syrian conflict started, where I met David.
And so did you meet David in Syria, or were you back in the UK, and did you chat on the phone, meet in person? You said, hey, I'm here. I'm passionate about this. I have family in Syria. I'm seeing what's happening. And how did you get connected? And then from there, did the Knott Foundation just spring up as something, or did you both travel back for missions? And how did that play out?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So when we got back from our first mission in Syria, as British Syrian surgeons, we were invited to the Royal College of Surgeons of England to do the STAY course. The STAY course stands for the Surgical Training in the Austere Environment in the Royal College. So when we went there, of course, who's in charge of the course and who's the course director? Mr. David Knott. And that's how I met David in the course. We talked about Syria, and apparently he was in Syria at the same time when we were in Aleppo, but in a different city. He was with MSF, Doctors Without Borders.
Right.
But we didn't know that. And we talked about it, and he said, look, I want to go to Syria. He contacted one of my colleagues in Action for Humanity, which is Syria Relief, the charity that we went with, and we continue to work with in Syria. So, and he said, I want to go with you. We want to go together to Syria again with Action for Humanity. And a few weeks after the course, we were off to Syria again with David, with Action for Humanity. And that's it. Since then, we've never stopped. We went on all our missions together, apart from, I think I missed two of his missions. But yeah, went to Syria several times, Syrian-Turkish borders, Yemen several times, to Libya, to Iraq, Cameroon, Kenya. We went to West Bank and right. Gaza. So several places, all these missions, and to Ukraine, several times to Ukraine. All these missions, we went together. And it was really eye-opening. And I felt I was the luckiest surgeon to be there with David, working with him. And I've learned so much from him. And
you played a starry role in his book, again, War Doctor, Surgery on the Front Lines. And I know a lot of folks listening have read the book. But for those who haven't, can you share a couple stories from your time in Syria?
Let me talk about when I worked with David. So we went to Syria together, and every time we go, we stay for 6 weeks up to 3 months. We take unpaid leave from the NHS and we go there and do this work. We stay with the local surgeons there in Aleppo or in Bab el-Hawa, and we live in the hospital itself, sharing a room with the Syrian, local Syrian surgeons, living day to day, eating with them, operating with them, teaching them in the evenings when there is a bit of time. And during that time, I've learned so much from David, operative-wise, skill-wise, and even from his personality. David is a unique human being. He is so passionate about his work, so passionate about his patient, so passionate about teaching and delivering his knowledge that he's gained over the years from going to war zones to deliver it to the doctors that were there with him, doctors who were dealing with casualties on the front line. And he's so knowledgeable, and his surgical skills are just absolutely great. And all of these, and you have a very humble, down-to-earth man that really, you know, capture your respect. So I've learned so much from him during these first missions to Syria, and I continue to learn from him every time we go there. The conflict in Syria was so complex and still very complex. And I remember once we were, after a very long day and operating through the night, we went to the room and we tried to get some sleep. And then David was called down to theater because there was a gunshot wound injury to her chest. A young man was shot in the chest. And they wanted to open the chest, and they never done that before. So David was the person to teach them and show them how to do that. So David went down, and then immediately I followed David. And in theater, while we were operating, trying to stop the bleeding, did a clamshell. Someone else enters the theater. And apparently, this was an ISIS fighter that was brought to the hospital. And his brother or his teammates, or with their guns, stormed into the theater and wanting to know what's going on with the patient. And is he going to survive? And who's operating on him? Yeah. And that is extremely scary, because if they knew that there are two British surgeons there, that would have been a disaster. So I just tried to, in my own way, tried to reassure David. And I spoke with my Syrian colleague to these people, and in an Arabic accent, telling them, look,
wow,
we're operating on him. You need to leave theater to enable us to treat him. Once we're done, we'll let you through and you can see him. But for now, please leave the operating theater. And it was a very scary one.
That's an understatement.
And another story that I remember, again, it wasn't in theater. We were going from Aleppo to another city with the Aleppo Medical Council in a small minibus, moving to another city to try and do some work and support them there. And we had a flat tire, and we had to stop. And we didn't know where we stopped, still in open fields with a hill. And on the top of the hill, there's a post, like a small room that people can look onto the road. And one of the Syrian guard doctors said, look, we need to do it quickly because this is most likely an ISIS area. We need to get out of here as quickly as possible. So I told David, stay in the minibus, lie down on the chair at the back of the minibus, cover yourself completely. Do not come out of the minibus, whatever happens. And within minutes, we can see a car coming towards us, a Jeep with a black flag on it. And they stopped, and immediately in a very aggressive way, they said, what are you doing here? And who are you? So we spoke to them. We told them, look, we are the medical council from Aleppo. We're doctors. We just had a flat tire, and we're going to repair it and move on to another hospital. And they said, immediately, you have to leave as soon as you finish. If we come back and we find you here, he'll be detained. And they left. And trust me, that was the quickest and the fastest.
Like a pit crew.
Plans I had changed.
Oh, gosh.
Change in I've seen in my life. And we left. So we had so many close moments that we looked danger in the eye. But we survived it. We survived it together. We survived it looking out for each other and supporting each other. And really, that's what I love about these missions. And in particular, missions like the Syria mission. You have this coherence. You have this relationship that you build and you develop, friendship between the whole team. And you become like one family. And it's amazing. It's truly amazing.
How do you balance the risk to yourself and your colleagues with the important work that you're doing? You know, you have to be alive to do that work and to continue on with these humanitarian missions. And so how does that balance out?
It's very difficult. It's really difficult to balance that. But when we prepare for the mission, we try to make it as safe as possible. We do security checks. We do security assessment. And we have local teams on the ground that we trust. And we try to have a low profile. Can even remember in Aleppo, instead of calling David, we used to call him an Arabic name, Abu Dhani. So people, when you call them that name, people don't think, oh, there's a foreigner here. Or yeah. There is. No, actually. So you try and do that, do your best to make it as safe as possible. In spite of all that, you can only try. You can't guarantee that you won't get shot, abducted, your hospital bombed, and unfortunately that happened several times. You get sniped on the way from one place to another. And I remember once when we used to, in Aleppo, there were like four or five field hospitals. And when I say field hospitals, it's a small building that turned into a small hospital. And we usually operate underground because of the barrel bombs. And sometimes they need us in another hospital. They, over the walkie-talkie, they tell us, can you come? We need you there. We've got an urgent case. So we get into a small car with the local doctor and we drive. And it's in the night. You cannot put the lights on. It's completely dark. Because if you put your lights on, there are aircraft and jet fighters in the circulating the skies.
And just launch out of your eye.
Absolutely. So you can't really make it 100% safe. But you can always try. Do your best. And when you go and see the amount of the benefits that these patients get from such expertise, from such work, people like David, you think it's definitely worthwhile. And you go again and again.
Right, that has to be the case, right? That the benefit is so extraordinarily great that you see the work you're doing is so important that when it comes to weighing those risks and benefits, that the risk is high as that is, but the benefits still outweigh that.
Once you go and see the benefits, see how people are benefiting, patients, doctors, locals, you would think definitely it's worth it. Definitely the benefits overweighs the dangers and the risks.
And you wanted to amplify that benefit farther, and one of the best ways to do that is to train local populations of surgeons. Take, for example, Syria. You mentioned the lack of exposure to some of these horrible traumatic injuries. And you can only be there so much. Dr. Knott can only be there so much. And so one of your missions through the Knott Foundation is to train surgeons and other medical providers to become skilled in delivery of care. So what's the Knott Foundation up to now? What are some of the highest performing, I guess, or most sought after courses? And what are you most proud about in terms of the work you're doing through the foundation?
Yeah, the foundation, like you mentioned earlier, started in 2015, and the idea came from Ellie Knott, and Ellie is David's wife. She's a very wise humanitarian, very passionate about this work, very passionate about helping people in such circumstances, and she's very passionate about the foundation itself, and she just said to David, look, you've got all this experience, you've got all this knowledge. Why don't you start a foundation or charity that does that thing, that does this training, deliver this training to the people who need it the most? And that's how the foundation started. And I was privileged to be with them from day one during the early days of the foundation. And we started to go. It's really good and well to go and operate for a couple of weeks and come back. But really what's more important is you go and operate. You train the surgeons, you train the medics there on how to do these procedures. You come back, you stay in touch with them, you go back again, and you do an assessment and you support them again with extra knowledge, extra skills, till they're confident to do the work themselves and to be trainers themselves. And that's the aim of the main goal of the foundation, is to build capacity, to train the local surgeons in conflict zones on how to deal with such complex injuries. And once they're trained, when they're happy, then they'll be able to train their colleagues and so forth. And that's exactly what we did in Syria. We stayed with these doctors, with these surgeons, so many weeks, months, that we went there again and again. We did the training for them. We did the assessment. And that eventually, when the foundation was started, we started doing these courses, which I'll explain about the courses in a minute. But we formed a local faculty in Syria of the David Nutt Foundation. So the last two missions to Syria, they were delivered by local faculty in Arabic to their colleagues. We just went there to support them. And this is really the aim that we want to do. We want to make them self-sufficient. And it's exactly what we're doing in Ukraine at the moment. We've done so many missions in Ukraine. We're training doctors, we're training surgeons. And in our last course that we did in the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh, we trained 6 or 7 Ukrainian surgeons on delivering the course in Ukraine. And they went and they did the first training there. So we're hoping to achieve the same goal in Ukraine, hoping to do the same in Yemen, in Libya, and so forth. So for the foundation, really, this is the most important aim. And this is what we're proud of. It's a unique product that we have. I don't think there's any charity or big organization that has this kind of training, knowledge, equipment, and planning. And that's what we're proud of, really. And to talk about the training that we do and the foundation. So initially, we were doing the training as part of the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh, the state course, which is surgical training in the austere environment, where the foundation was sponsoring surgeons and doctors to come to the UK, do the course, and then they go back. So they cover their expenses, their trouble, their visas, their accommodation, the course fees, and they go back to train their colleagues.
And that's a cadaver-based course, correct?
Exactly. That's a cadaveric course. 5 days, very intense. We teach on damage control surgery, damage control resuscitation. We do abdominal trauma, cardiothoracic trauma, vascular trauma. We do plastics for trauma. We do obstetrics in trauma patients. We do maxillofacial and we do neurosurgery. So very intense 5 days. We show the candidates the operations. We give them a scenario or case-based teaching. So we show them a case from real life that we faced and we dealt with, we operated on in the field. And we tell them, what do you do? What do you think the next step would be? And we teach them a systematic way in approaching such cases. And then we show them the video, how to operate on. After they've seen the video, they go to Heston, which is our human-sized mannequin that you saw in Belfast, which is the most popular, the most famous part of our foundation.
And now you're moving to Heston, for everyone listening, it's truly life-size. It's a silicone model, right? But it's extraordinarily unique in the sense that the foresight that was put into its design, it is so useful. every inch of that model is used, and it's incredible for all the different exposures, all the different skill sets. And we mentioned before, the other course is cadaver-based. You can travel with Heston, right? You take Heston with you to some of these more austere environments. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So Heston is a human-sized mannequin that has all the normal organs inside it. And it has all the 30 or 40 emergency trauma operations and exposures on it. So you can, like I said, you can do burr holes, you can see extradural, subdural hematomas and how you deal with that. You can do surgical airway, you can do a clamshell, lung twist, you can do trauma laparotomy, you can do plastic surgery on Heston. And for obstetrics, we have separate mannequin for that in particular, like obstructed labor or emergency cesarean section and so forth. And once they've seen that, and correctly, like you mentioned, for the Austrian environment, we developed the HEST course. So people who cannot come to the UK to do the training, which there's hundreds, if not thousands of them, are not able to make it to the UK to do the HEST course. We decided to take the course with us, make it into a mobile course, and we call it Hostile Environment Surgical Training. We take Heston with us. The whole team goes to do the training. We have a model that we've developed. For example, we have a model of the heart and a pericardium. And once they've seen how to deal with cardiac injuries, how to repair a penetrating injury to the right ventricle, for example, they see it on Heston and they go and practice it on the models that they have.
Yeah.
And all of these, including Heston, they're all handmade specifically for the course, for the foundation.
Yeah, and this makes art and skill that went into that model is truly amazing. It is one of a kind. It's the best I've seen anywhere in the world. And again, the planning into each of those organ systems and exposures is truly magnificent.
It is, and it took about 2 to 3 years to develop it.
I believe that.
And we're still developing Heston. We're still adding things to Heston. And Max, the artist who did Heston, yeah, of course, with the supervision of David, does all these models too and prepare them for each mission. So each mission we go, we carry all this equipment with us. We carry like about 12, 13 bags of equipment, including, in addition to Heston, which has his own special bag. And the funny thing is, Patrick, when you go and into these countries, into countries where war zones or in the Middle East, and the custom officer asks you, what's inside this bag?
Sure.
And you tell him, there's a mannequin that you train surgeons on. Oh, open it.
Yep.
I need to see it. Are you sure? Yes, open it, definitely. And we open the bag, and he looks at Heston, and it's so funny to see the shock on their faces. It's absolutely hilarious. But again, that's part of one of these missions, to watch the customs officer looking at
squirm a little bit. Yeah. All right. So you were recently in Gaza, and you're going back to Gaza again shortly. I understand it was very challenging in regards to the extent of destruction and human suffering. How do you feel when you go on these missions? How do you cope when you're there, because the emotions have to be overwhelming?
Gosh, that's a difficult question. Yes, I've been to Gaza with the WHO, and that was beginning of this year, because of what we do and the expertise that we have. We've been asked to deploy there to support the local teams. And to be honest, it was one of the most difficult missions that I've done. I've done many of them, but this was one of the most difficult ones because of the suffering. You go inside there, the amount of displacement, huge long queues of children waiting to get clean water, some food. You go into the hospital, is surrounded by makeshift tents of thousands of families because they've been displaced, running away, and they thought that the hospital is a safe place to stay in. And you walk inside the hospital, again, it's full of families living there because there's no place for them to go. Very limited resources. In the UK, in our hospital, we might have a mass casualty once in a year or twice in a year, there every day there's a mass casualty coming into them. And with the limited resources, with the limited manpower, you tend to make very difficult decisions on who you're going to operate on and who you're going to leave. And it's a very hard decision. You make these decisions with the local doctors, of course. It's not a single decision. And I still remember the faces of these children that we couldn't, we said, we can't do anything for them. And we didn't do anything, just left them to die because we couldn't do much. We only had limited number of beds, limited number of theaters, sutures, materials, surgical equipment, antibiotics, very limited antibiotics. All wounds there were infected, all of it. And, you know, I can tell you stories. One of the boys who was injured before we arrived, in a month before we arrived, they had to do an laparotomy because of fragment injury to the abdomen. And the wound dehiscent. So the wound opened and started to leak from his bowel, so had multiple fistulas. So anything he eats or drinks comes out straight from his abdomen. And the boy didn't eat for a whole month. So we went to see him. He was like skin on bone. And it was just, we thought he's going to die. Yeah, if he doesn't get any treatment or taken out of Gaza, this boy will die. We gave him a lollipop, you know, sweet, and his face just lightened up. He was so happy to have this sweet. It's really heartbreaking. And unfortunately, we had to cut our mission short because of an incident in the safe house that we're staying in. The whole team, we are British, four British surgeons and one Canadian. The house, it was deconflicted, which means WHO, the UN, everyone has the coordinates of this house and agreed that it's a safe house for this emergency medical team under the WHO to stay in, and it's a green zone. At 6 o'clock in the morning, when we're preparing to go back, when we took a break and we went to go back again to the hospital, we were hit by an airstrike. And this airstrike just hit the outside wall of the building. And luckily, the sand absorbed the explosion of the fragments. And if that rocket was 3 meters closer, I wouldn't have been here speaking to you today. So it's like I said, it's one of the most difficult missions I've done. And I'm sure when I go now, it will be much worse. I don't know what to expect. But we've been asked to go, and there's a huge need for that. So let's see what happens. Maybe when I come back, I'll let you know.
I think we'd all like to know. How do you prepare mentally to go back to a situation like that where you were mere meters away from being blown up by a rocket, and where you, as a visitor, have to absorb that human suffering, knowing that you have limited resources? I'm assuming a significant number of these injuries could be dealt with in a well-resourced area. How do you think about it? Let's pray and hope you make it there and back. But you have to come back and leave those people behind. And I'm sure that tears at you. And so how are you preparing for all of this? There's a lot of feelings in surgery. And there's a lot of feelings in surgery in a well-resourced, non-austere environment in which there's not a terrible war going on.
It's really difficult. But again, once you see the amount of suffering and how much you can benefit these people, then you start to think about that. You concentrate on that. Try to not to think too much about the dangers that you will be facing. I try to reassure myself that everything is set up, hopefully to be safe for our team to be deployed there. To come back. It's frustrating to have limited resources because a lot of these injuries can be dealt with here in the UK, and I'm sure same thing in the States, that if one patient comes as a trauma, you have the whole trauma team there. You have 7-8 specialists dealing with that one person. There you have one doctor dealing with 10 major injuries. again, it's difficult. But then you think about saving one life, it's worth it. And this is what makes the whole thing worthwhile. If I go there and contribute into saving even one life, one child, I think that's good enough for me. Go back again. And it's, you asked about feelings, really. It's difficult to describe it, Patrick, because it's, in one way, it's very rewarding. If you see your patients getting better, your child, the child that you operated on, or the man or the woman that they were almost dying, and after a few days, they're walking out of the hospital, smiling and saying, thank you and goodbye. That means the whole world to me. And I think that is worth everything, that really. And that's the rewarding thing, that the relationship, the friendship that you build with the doctors there, with your teammates, with the surgeons and the medics in the hospital that you're working in, it's lifelong friendship. And really, you cannot compare it with anything else. But on the other hand, it is quite stressful when you think about it, and I try not to think about it too much, because you're going and there's a risk of injury, there's a risk of death, and you've got your family, and you need to let your family know they should be on your side supporting you. And I've been really blessed with a very supportive family. My mother, bless her, she's always supportive, and I know she worries a lot. My children, my daughter, Shada, who's 19 now doing psychology, worries a lot, and sometimes she cries and sends me messages. My son, the same thing. He's always messaging me, are you okay? What did you do today? He doesn't want to scare me, but he tried to, you know, get a reply from me to say, well, I'm good, don't worry, I'm okay. And, you know, when I operate, being a father put things in prospect for me. So when I operate, I had one of the patients that I had was a girl, and a young girl, and that was in Syria. And she was, at that time, the age of my daughter. Mm. And she had a blast injury, with fragments injury to the abdomen and to the bottom area. So we had to operate, repair the injured bowel, and bring a stoma out, defunction because of the injuries at the bottom end. And every time I looked at that girl, I took my daughter being there. Every time that girl cried or was in pain, I felt that my daughter is crying and in pain. Similar with my son. I had a 5 or 6 year old boy who came with a fragment chest injury that we had to do a thoracoabdominal incision to repair the chest, an injured lung, the diaphragm, and took the spleen out because of the fragment. And that boy, when he woke up, he didn't have any family around him. And I'll tell you in a minute why he didn't have his family around. His father brought him to us and then disappeared. And when that child woke up, I found a small toy and I took it to him to, you know, just to cheer him up a little bit. He looked at me, and this is the first time I see a child crying without a sound. His tears were coming down, and he didn't say a word. He looked at me, took the toy, and just turned his face away. That broke my heart. I imagined my son is there in his position, and I felt so bad. After a couple of days, he didn't have any of his family, so the patient next to him, his mother, the child next to him, his mother started to look after this boy. After 2 days, the father came back and he said, oh, I'm asking about my son. So I was really frustrated with the dad. That, where did you go? Where did you leave your son and go? He said, I'm so sorry, doctor, when I brought him, the barrel bomb hit our house or our building. I brought him to you and I knew that he's going to be safe in the hospital. I went back to my house to dig out my daughters and my wife. And I just managed to get them out and I buried them and I came back for myself. I just sat down in tears, to be honest. So it's difficult. It's really difficult. But having supportive family, you know, they understand what you do. My kids understand that, and they support me. And I'm so grateful for this. My wife, Ala, is a humanitarian psychologist. And herself, she does a lot of humanitarian stuff, work and support in war zones, and have a lot of trouble. So between us, we understand our work and we support each other. So every time I go on a mission, she understands. She's there supporting the family. When she goes on a mission, I'm supporting the family and supporting her. And that makes a huge difference. Not just that, having friends and colleagues like David, like people who we have in Syria, in Yemen, in all these countries that we travel to, in Ukraine, we know that we have a big family and we support each other. And also having a supportive workplace. And I'm really grateful for my work, the Manchester University NHS Foundation Trust, from the management to my colleagues. They've been absolutely fantastic and supportive. They understand the work that we do in the foundation. They support that my leave. And when I come back, they're always very supportive and happy to see me back. And that makes a huge difference, really. Everyone has their own motivation and reasons why they do this work. For me, and above all, it's my faith. As a practicing Muslim, there's a huge emphasis on saving lives and helping others. And this is a hugely rewarding.
Well, Dr. Darwish, you are truly an exceptional human. Your family is exceptional. The Knott Foundation, Dr. David Knott, Ellie, everyone there is doing such important work. And I'm so grateful you were able to share it. I'm behind a knife, and I hope a lot of people hear this. I hope a lot of people also look into the David Knott Foundation. We'll put the link, it's davidknottfoundation.com, into the show notes, so that if folks want to support the work you're doing, they can, and there's lots and lots of different ways to do so. Again, we thank you for your time and wish you the safest of travels at your upcoming trip back to Gaza.
Just one last thing. Thank you very much for having me, Patrick. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of Behind the Knife, and I look forward really to build and working with yourself and with your team in the future, really, with the David Knott Foundation. We have a lot of partners like Action for Humanity, the WHO, and we cherish and we value these partnerships. And we try to reach as much people as we can. You know, we're really privileged as medical professionals. We have the knowledge, the expertise to save lives, to alleviate the suffering. And we should really be using this and helping people to, you know, to cure people and get them better. And all of us, even if you're not a medic, you can still be a true humanitarian. The way you deal with your family, your workplace, your neighbors, your community, the way you are nice to them, as long as your aim is to stop the suffering, you are a true humanitarian. And just last thing is, for my colleagues who are interested, please go out there, do your best, do no harm, and alleviate the suffering and dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.
We'll be right back.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one-coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5-quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7-9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.